Last time we were in this room was 2 months ago, and we had a film, The War Game, a very old film, and the debate was CND. The Socialist Party of Great Britain, Birmingham branch, is really trying to focus during this year particularly on these issues of great concern to people. It's not difficult to find them, of course. One of the things, though, the people who attended that last debate will have noticed, if they didn't know us before, is that although we're terribly concerned about these things, what we talk about are facts. You won't find from the Socialist Party of Great Britain anything but a scientific analysis of present society and the object of socialism put before you. You won't find calls to the barricades, direct action, bash the police, or any of that sort of stupid juvenile talk. What we're doing is talking about serious adult politics and what really is the case. Now this evening, we're attempting to show that there is a common cause between the subject we were concerned with last time, which is nuclear weapons. There is a common cause between that and present rising level of unemployment in this country and many other countries. And Steve Coleman of Ilford Branch, Islington Branch, sorry, yeah, both begin with I, sorry, is going to talk on that title, The Bomb and the Bell Cue, and tell you more about the course, Steve.
Okay, thanks so much, Gary. We are now living in the age of the petrol bomb and the neutron bomb. And the petrol bombs are the product of a society which puts the needs of the majority of people quite definitely secondary to the needs of a minority of people in society. It arises from people's frustration at being told that the only place for them in society is at the bottom of the heap, whether they are employed or unemployed, at the bottom of the heap. And the neutron bomb, with its capacity to kill people but to preserve property, is the technological reflection of a system of society in which human life must be periodically sacrificed to the modern secular god of profit. Now, I want to begin with a couple of predictions, and they're not predictions which I make with any sense of political satisfaction. In the coming weeks, we are going to see not only the dole queues getting longer and longer, but we are going to see more petrol bombs flying, and we are going to see more violence breaking out in the streets. Not because anyone stands in a meeting place like this and suggests that it ought to happen, or suggests that it shouldn't happen, but because people who are in a position of insecurity will act in a way that is spontaneous and that they consider to be in their immediate interests, even if it isn't. And I will also make the prediction that in the coming weeks, as the trade crisis facing the industrial nations of the world becomes more and more acute, the weapons industry will become busier and busier. It will be the profitable and productive section of world industry. Indeed, by the time that this meeting is over this evening, at 9:30, 10 o'clock, the present British government, on its own, will have spent an extra £3.3 million on armaments expenditure. At the moment, it spends £1.4 million on average every hour. So what we are talking about is a prediction of a society becoming more and more insecure for the majority of people. Now, this party, the Socialist Party of Great Britain, as the chairman says, does not deal in fantasies about barricades. We are not concerned to sit around imagining an apocalypse which may come tomorrow or the next year. We are concerned to do something positive, which is going to put a stop to the insecurity which faces the majority of people, faces all of us here. And in order to do this, in order to take a unified look at the problems of the society we live in, we have to trace a common cause for those problems. And in order to do that, we have to look at what the system is which we live under. And so I want to begin by making a few very clear statements about what capitalism means. Because it is the capitalist system of society which exists all over the world today. Whether it's in Russia or in America, whether it's in Britain or in China. In every industrialized, advanced economy throughout the world, the predominant social system is capitalism. And whether you use that as a swear word or whether you use capitalism as a term to mark the culmination of world history, it has a definite meaning. Capitalism is a way of organizing social affairs. And we are all part of society, whether we want to be or not. And we're part of society because we need each other in order to live. We need each other in order to produce and distribute wealth, in order to build houses, to grow food, in order to produce an adequate transport service, in order to keep hospitals running. We need each other, and we cannot survive without that economic cooperation. But under capitalism, the present social system, the means of producing and distributing wealth are owned and controlled by a minority. The land, the factories, the mines, the means of communication, all of these are not the common possession of everyone. They do not belong to us, but they are the possession of a small, self-perpetuating class. In Britain, that class division is quite clear for anyone to look at. The richest 1% of the population own more of the accumulated wealth than the poorer 80%. And 1/1000th of the population own 80% of all stocks and shares. Throughout the world, approximately 10% of the people own about 9/10 of all of the wealth. So the first feature of capitalism is its social inequality of power. Wealth and the ability to produce wealth, the machinery to produce wealth, and the land in which wealth is produced, all of that is concentrated in the hands of a very small minority of people. And the overwhelming majority of people in society own between them a negligible share of the world's wealth. And this class of people own only one thing which they can sell, and this is vitally important in order to understand capitalism. And the thing which members of the working class can sell is our ability to work, to go out and get a job, to get a wage or a salary. And it doesn't matter whether it is a wage or whether it is a salary. It doesn't put you in a different class. It simply means that if you get a wage, it runs out in the middle of the week, and if you get a salary, it runs out in the middle of the month. And the position of most people here this evening, and the position of most people who cannot afford nuclear fallout shelters, and the position of the majority of people who were rioting on the streets, and the position of the majority of people who dressed up in blue uniforms in order to defend other people's property, the position of the vast majority of people is that one, to have one basic saleable possession, and that is our ability to work, to be a worker. Now, capitalism is a society where you have to sell your ability to work to the highest bidder. It's a buying and selling system. And according to the defenders of capitalism, capitalism is the best way of organizing the production and distribution of wealth. In other words, what they say is, you can't have any other system. You've got to have prices. You've got to have wages. You've got to have buying and selling. You've got to have supermarkets. You've got to have markets. You've got to have property. Because if you don't have those things, people won't be able to get what they want. So we'll take a look at this and see how well capitalism provides people with what they want. Let's take food as an example, because we all want food, some of us more than others. At the moment, 15 million people die every year as a result of starvation. These aren't our figures, they are figures produced by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. And that amounts to one person every 2 seconds dying of starvation. And to put this into perspective, if you consider that 120,000 people were killed by the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, then you can realize that at the moment, the same number of people, in fact it's more, 150,000 people, are killed by capitalism every 3 days as a result of not having enough food to eat. And that's 120 people every 3 days as a result of the buying and selling system which is supposed to satisfy needs. And at the same time, according to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, in a report in 1977, the present world food resources are capable of feeding 7 times the present world's food population. The same report stated, and I quote, "Enough grain is now produced to provide everyone on earth with more than 2 pounds of grain per day." Yet, the Financial Times, not very long ago, reported that 20 million tons of grain were being guarded by soldiers in India, while millions of Indian workers and peasants are starving to death. And that's a buying and selling system which provides people, according to the defenders of capitalism, with what they want because they paid for it. And in 1978, the European Economic Community destroyed nearly 200,000 tons of fruit and vegetables, according to the Times, on the 14th of November 1978. And why did they destroy them? Because people didn't want them? No. People are starving. They destroyed them because the buying and selling system says, if you haven't got the money, you don't eat. The food is destroyed. So that's the efficiency of the capitalist system. And the same goes for housing, where at the moment there are record queues of homeless people needing accommodation, 55,000 officially homeless families in Britain, and at the same time there is the most severe contraction in the building industry since 1945. The same goes for energy, where the Electricity Board has announced a cutback on the production of electricity, and at the same time, every winter, more and more people, particularly old workers, are dying as a result of a illness produced by society, not a natural illness, called hypothermia, which the medical profession calls lack of heat, and which the Socialist Party calls lack of money, because that is the shortage which produces it, not a shortage of electricity. And the same goes for the health service, where they are closing down hospitals at the moment, while the queues for beds are at a post-war peak. So the buying and selling system fails to satisfy human needs. It fails on a perfectly simple observation that there are a lot of needs which are being unmet at the moment, and at the same time, people are running a system in which profits are the main aim of production. So let's begin to look a little bit further at what can be done about this profit system. Because there are a lot of people, we're not the only ones in this room this evening or in the Socialist Party generally, who understand that putting profit before need is not a wise way to run society. But there are a lot of people who say, well, okay, what you've got to do is run capitalism where you give a bit more concern for need, where you reform capitalism and make it into an acceptable society for working class people to live in. And according to them, the problems we face, starvation, unemployment, the build-up of armaments, homelessness, these are problems which are generated not by the structure of the economy, not by the inherent features of capitalism, but by wrong policies for running capital. And Michael Foot, speaking in Cardiff a couple of weeks ago, gave the answer that the Labour Party, if elected into power again, would do what it's done in the past. It would increase public expenditure. And Mr. Foot said quite clearly, and it's also stated in the document which Mr. Benn supports, the alternative economic strategy, that one of the key ways to reduce unemployment is to increase public expenditure. Now, let's have a look at this idea. Because if it was a bright new idea for running capitalism, maybe we should agree with it. Between 1973 and 1980, government expenditure continuously increased. In fact, it was one of the most massive increases in public expenditure in the history of British capitalism. In 1973, public expenditure by the British government stood at £20,000 million, that's £20 billion. And unemployment stood at 500,000. By 1975, government expenditure by the British government increased to £36,000 million. And unemployment had gone up to 1 million. In 1979, government public expenditure stood at £61,000 million, and unemployment had reached 1.5 million. And last year, public expenditure by the government had reached £80,000 million, and unemployment had reached 2.5 million. So if you remember, according to the bright idea which Michael Foot put forward in Cardiff a few weeks ago, if you increase expenditure by the Treasury, you increase prosperity and you provide jobs for people. Yet the reality, the historical truth about the way that capitalism has run, is that between 1973 and 1980, Treasury expenditure has quadrupled from £20 billion to £80 billion, and unemployment has quintupled from 500,000 to 2.5 million. In other words, the so-called alternative economic policy, which claims that increased government expenditure is the only way to stop unemployment, if it is applied to the test of history, shows that not only is it wrong, but that it is the complete opposite to what has actually happened. A graph showing an increase in public expenditure during 73 to 80 would show an even greater increase in unemployment. But then, if you say, let's not listen to what Michael Foot and the Keynesian economists have to say, you can then turn to Mrs. Thatcher and her monetarist economic policies, in which she follows the ideas of Professor Milton Friedman. And if you apply those to the test of history, you'll find they're equally erroneous. Mrs. Thatcher says exactly the opposite to Mr. Foot. Foot says increase expenditure, unemployment will go down. Thatcher says decrease expenditure and unemployment will go down. Yet between 1850 and 1913, there was absolutely no inflation of the currency in order to support public expenditure, and a relative stability of government public expenditure. And yet at the same time, unemployment was continuous. And in the Depression 1931 to 1938, prices were stable, but unemployment was as high as it is now. So the various politicians and economists involve themselves in a rather ridiculous game of one saying increase expenditure, and another one saying decrease expenditure, and both of them failing to recognise that the real problem is not how much money the government prints, And it is not how much money there is circulating in the economy. The real problem is what happens at the point of production, where the priority is given not to the consumption of wealth and the utilization of abundant resources so that people can have access to it, but when the priority is always given to ensuring that a profit is received by the owner of the factory or the farm or the mine, regardless of the needs of either the producer or the consumer, who, of course, in class terms, is generally speaking the same person. In other words, the people who are producing most of the wealth are consuming most of the wealth. Now, there are some people who may even go along with us and accept that not only is there something wrong with a society which puts profit before needs, but there's something wrong with a society which, despite increasing, decreasing, and doing all kinds of other things to public expenditure, despite Keynesian economic policies and Friedmanite economic policies and all kinds of other economic policies, fails to satisfy the needs of the majority of people. There are some people who say, yes, we agree that a revolutionary alternative is needed, that you can't just tinker with the economy. But, and there is always the inevitable but, they will say, in the meantime, what we need to do is certainly not tinker with the economy, but we've got to do something about the threat which faces us in terms of nuclear destruction, in terms of the bomb. And the way in which those people want to bring this about, and many of them are organised in a campaign called the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, has to be looked at. And again, we've got to put it scientifically, as the chairman said, against the record of history and see how well this is going to work. Work out whether it's a set of serious principles for getting rid of bombs. According to the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, there are several tactical moves that the working class has got to make in order to get rid of the threat of war. And the first tactic is that you do absolutely nothing about getting rid of the religious, nationalistic, and chauvinistic principles which many members of the working class have. In other words, if you want to join the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and go along to the church on a Sunday morning and look up at the roof and say, I hope you'll look after me for the coming week, you can do it. In fact, the leader of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Bruce Kent, is one of the ringleaders of people who does it. If you want to join the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and be one of the people who backs Britain, waves flags, organises in street parties, street riots, doesn't matter which, you can do it. If you want to join a campaign for nuclear disarmament, but at the same time support the Liberal Party because it gives the small man a chance, you can do it. If you want to join a campaign for nuclear disarmament and you think capitalism is a bad system, but, of course, luckily they haven't got capitalism in Russia where the workers aren't even able to join trade unions, you can do it. If you want to join the campaign for nuclear disarmament because you think that the only way to beat the Russians is by using tanks, and that'd be a lot cheaper for our government and our taxpayers instead of producing neutron bombs, that's all right. You've got a place in there. You produce guns instead of nuclear weapons. All of that is a part of that campaign. And that's tactic one. You do nothing about eradicating the basic support for capitalism, which is a feature of capitalism and which enables it to exist. And then comes tactic two. You go along to the polling station when you are invited to do so, and you vote for a leader to carry on running capitalism for you. And according to the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and they say it quite openly, they are not a political organisation, you can vote for who you like and be a member of CND. They even boast that they've got members of the Conservative Party. So you can go and vote for Mrs. Thatcher. You can vote for Mr. Foote if you want expenditure put up, Mrs. Thatcher if you want it brought down, the Liberals if you want it just about where it is. And by doing that, you are electing people to carry on running the profit system. And if you read any of their manifestos, they'll tell you that's exactly what they're going to do, run the profit system to the best of their ability. And then comes tactic number three of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. which is that you sit back, having elected your leaders, and you wait for them to run capitalism in the same way as they always run capitalism. That is to say, in the interest of the minority of people who own the wealth of society, who own the productive machinery. And in order to defend those people, the government has certain obligations. These obligations are that they must defend property, and they must expand markets, and they have to join in economic alliances with other sections of the capitalist class, and they have to maintain a competitive armed force in order to defend the property of those who matter under capitalism. And this is precisely what every government has done under capitalism and must do under capitalism. And quite frankly, to complain about them doing it, having given them the job, is really not very sensible. And then comes tactic number 4 of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, which is that you organise processions and meetings and demonstrations in order to plead with the government not to run its military force in a manner that may endanger you or upset you at all. In other words, you say to them, by all means carry on defending capitalism, but if you don't mind, do it with the kind of weapons that will leave us out of it. And by all means carry on expanding your markets and waving your flags and getting us to wave your flags, but if you don't mind, carry on the war somewhere else, perhaps out in Africa, where it's not going to bother us. And that is the request made by these campaigners. And the leaders quite rightly turn round to the people who elected them and say, get lost. Unless, of course, they're in opposition, in which case they say, well, yes, all right, we'll see what we can do about it. And then when they get into power, they then say, get lost. And they're quite right to do that, because if the working class elects a government to run capitalism for the capitalists, that is what you must expect them to do. And to expect anything else is rather futile. There are some people, and I hope that by this final stage of what I have to say, those people will be the ones who are here, who are not members, who will have agreed with what I've said even up to this point. They will agree that a system which puts profits before needs is not a sensible one. They will agree that it's no good tinkering with the economic policies of capitalism. It's no good increasing expenditure. It's no good decreasing expenditure. They will agree that it's no good electing leaders to run capitalism and then going to those leaders and say, well, we elected you to run capitalism, but don't do it in the way that you're supposed to do it. They will agree with us up to there. And then they will say, but we do not like this idea of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, that the only way you can do anything in order to eradicate the problems of capitalism is to get rid of capitalism, and the only way you could do that is by a social revolution which does away with the features of society that we know at the moment and introduces a new way of organising society. And it's understandable that many people are rather frightened and worried by this revolutionary idea, because they say, after all, look at the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 in Russia, and look at the consequences of what happened there. And then they listen to the barricade romanticists of the Socialist Workers' Party or the Workers' Revolutionary Party, who in the recent Greater London Council elections in the city that I come from brought out a manifesto saying that if they were elected they were going to bring down the tube fares to 20 pence, and you know, we all wondered what was revolutionary about it. And you can understand what they read in the newspapers about socialists starting up street riots and socialists haven't got a sense of fun and socialists aren't individuals. In fact, you know, the more we read it about ourselves in the papers as socialists, the more fascinated we are about these many facets of our characters. And these are what constitute the main obstacle to socialism at the moment. People's fear of change, people's belief that however bad what they've got at the moment happens to be, they'd better keep it because something different may be something that they're unable to handle. And these are the majority of working class people who are not stupid or wicked, who are not willfully opposed to a society in which there is peace, in which everyone is able to produce according to their ability and take according to their needs, but they are worried. And so it is necessary for me in conclusion to say what the Socialist Party of Great Britain means by this social revolution from capitalism to socialism. And the first thing to understand about revolution is that revolutionary ideas don't happen as a result of people waking up one morning with a revolutionary idea in their head and saying, let's go out and have a revolution. Ideas which people have are the result of experience. The idea of property, the institution of private property, didn't come into being because somebody woke up one morning long ago and said, I will have this house, I will own this donkey, I will own this bit of land. It happened as a result of an economic development in society in which, as human beings increasingly dominated and controlled the natural environment and natural resources, they were able to produce for their subsistence and above that. And capitalism itself did not arise in the first place as a political ideal. It was a system of social relations which existed within feudal society before this one, which caused capitalism to grow up. Because as the system of feudalism, where people were tied to the land, where the market was very localized, where power was very centralized, it was because of that and because of the increase in technology and in particular oceanic expansion into other parts of the world and greater domination over nature, that was what caused the breakdown of feudalism and the creation of capitalism. It was experience, not just an idea. And contrary to the textbook historians, industrialization itself did not arise because a lot of very clever and able people started inventing new machinery. It came about because of the need of the new capitalist class to produce cheap commodities in order to satisfy a rapidly growing world market. And revolutions occur, whether they are capitalist revolutions, industrial revolutions, they occur because the way in which things are organized, the way in which people experience things in their lives, come into conflict with the needs which people have. Now today, we are in the middle of such a conflict between people's needs and the way in which society is organized. Indeed, it could be argued that today we are in the middle of the most intense conflict of that kind which has ever occurred. Because it is a conflict in which production for profit poses the alternative very clearly for people. Either you continue to produce for profit, in which production for profit becomes increasingly synonymous with production for destruction, production for putting yourselves out of work, production for destroying the environment, or you produce for use, which becomes increasingly synonymous with creativity and production for need. So we've arrived at this alternative idea of socialism, not as a result of people waking up as utopians one morning and saying, we want a world where there is no unemployment. We want a world where we don't have to go out and sell ourselves to an employer, but where we can work in common because we own in common the wealth of the world. It didn't come about as a result of people simply saying, we want peace, because the desire for peace only comes about as a realistic possibility, as a result of the possibility of war and mass annihilation. And that is why it's not the Socialist Party of Great Britain which has brought you here this evening. And it wasn't a result of you somehow waking up this morning and long ago before you were born having a little tick put on your brain telling you that on this particular date you ought to go to a socialist meeting. It was history which has brought you here this evening, in the sense that there is a conflict which has been going on throughout history, which today, in this particular epoch, has reached an intensity that we now have to choose between the possibility of a socialist society in which all human beings, without distinction of race or sex, will commonly own and control the means of production and distribution, or else continue as we do now for as long as we are able to continue as we are now without the problem wiping us out before we reach the solution. In conclusion, I want to say that socialism is a scientific proposition which deserves your support and your immediate and committed and active support, because mankind only takes up those problems which it can solve. And those problems which we can solve today can only be solved not by hitting them on the head one by one, but by eliminating their common cause in one go.